So welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Andrew Lawson, who is the Chief Product Officer at Zopa. Hi, Andrew. How are you doing?
I'm very good, Adrian. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So, Andrew, for the benefit of our listeners and readers, can you tell us a little bit about you and a bit about the work that you do?
Of course. So, as you said, I'm the Chief Product Officer at Zopa, been with Zopa for about 3 years now. My career actually started at the end of the last millennia, which makes me sound very old, but I started building off credit scorecards and went to work for Capital One in the UK. I had a great time at Capital One, which was a fantastic business at the time, and took a very different approach to credit cards than had traditionally been taken. And I think we were really early pioneers of what now gets termed things like big data and customer-centric product design and business growth. And I really enjoyed that working environment. It was a very liberating place where everything was taken through the lens of data-driven decision-making, which really creates an organization and a culture where decision-making can be pushed down. So as a new grad, you get a tremendous amount of responsibility from day one, and I really enjoyed that.
Excellent.
And I did that for a few years and ended up doing a startup with Capital One in Italy, which was great fun. And then I left and I joined ABN AMRO, who were creating a similar type model doing direct lending in Spain, and was there for a little bit. And then I took a break from financial services and went into the world of strategy consulting. I went to a firm that was called Mercer Management Consultants at the time and then became Oliver Wyman.
Yes.
And it was actually the mothership from where Capital One had originated. So I was sort of, you know, went back to where it all came from. And it was the same problem-solving approach, tackling the same type of problems. Anything to do with industries trying to drive growth where they had some kind of long-term relationship or subscription with the customer. So things like pay TV, publishing, utilities, mobile, anything like that.
Okay.
And I was there for maybe 8 years.
Right.
And I did some work with digital companies, well, media companies out in the US that were dealing with this kind of new wave of digital disruption in the late noughties, I think we call them. And they were looking at how could we change our business models and become more customer centric in a similar way to places like Capital One. And then I came back to the UK and I was interested in why banking hadn't been disrupted to the same degree as other sectors like media. And I started doing a bit of work with some of the high street banks and I started looking at who were the people trying to disrupt financial services. And as I was working with the high street banks, I was disappointed in their approach to what I would call customer centricity or customer obsession. So, you know, a lot of the banks will talk about being customer obsessed, but it's hard to see real evidence of that when you get inside the banks.
Right.
And I don't want to go on a bank bashing session here, but what I mean by that is, you know, if you look inside a bank, you'll have the current account team will be isolated and siloed and kind of compete with your personal loans team, who will kind of compete with your credit card team. And actually all three of those teams are trying to serve in some instances the same customer need, whether that's through an overdraft or a personal loan or a credit card.
Sure.
And I find it hard to see how those companies are taking customer-led decisions when you have three teams competing for the same customer need.
Yeah.
And so I was disappointed to the degree to which the banks really had, since I had left financial services, changed. And I just didn't get the sense of passion for that change to happen. And so I started looking at who was trying to disrupt the world of financial services. And I came across peer-to-peer. And you don't have to do a lot of research into peer-to-peer to see the customer obsession that is behind the growth of peer-to-peer. And I think Lending Club articulated it very well when they talked about their business model being a kind of virtuous circle of, if we can find great customers and we lend money to good customers, then we'll get great credit risk performance. With great credit risk performance, we'll have a lower risk premium on our capital, which means we can attract capital at cheaper costs, which means we can lend it to customers at cheaper prices, which means we get better customers, which means we get better credit risk. It's this kind of virtuous circle.
Sure.
Which actually is, you know, very similar to what Amazon have. It's very similar to what Walmart have had for over 100 years. Let's drive down operating costs so we can pass better prices to customers, which means we'll sell more volume, which means we can command lower operating costs.
So sure.
It's a business built to solve customer problems, and the solving of those problems is intrinsic to the growth and success of a company. Mm-hmm. And you just don't see or hear that kind of thinking inside traditional banking environments. So I was really attracted to this peer-to-peer thing that was growing in around, I joined 2014. And that's when I came across SOPA. And stars aligned, and I joined a company that was on a mission. We were 50 people at the time, I think, lending about £20 million a month.
Yeah.
And I felt this was a company that had a sense of purpose and passion behind what it was trying to do. And that purpose and passion was both intense, and I felt in the right direction, which was, let's go solve problems for customers.
Perfect.
And that's really where Zopa came from.
But, I mean, you guys have had, like, it's a bit big back, so you've been around for a while. And also, yeah, I mean, you've been awarded super brand status in 2017, which is kind of a big deal for somebody that's not necessarily a high street sort of name. But, by the way, congrats on the super brand sort of thing. But it's like you're almost like punching – it feels like you're punching above your weight in many ways.
Yeah, I think that's a Zopa thing. In many ways. So, you know, we still in some ways think of ourselves as a startup, but we have been going for 13 years now.
Yes.
But we've never spent any money on building our brand. We've grown pretty organically.
Right.
And actually we've grown fairly cautiously as well. And that's been necessary because of the way that the peer-to-peer model works. And, you know, we take money from investors and we lend it out. And we give a return back to those lenders.
Sure.
And so we've had to grow cautiously because we've had to rely on the trust of our investors, which means we have to lend where we're pretty certain we're going to get the return that we tell our lenders we're going to get. So
sure.
our growth has been measured by our comfort around credit risk.
Right.
And that approach has been from day one, and that took us through the financial crisis of 2008 and really was the making of the company.
Mm-hmm.
But that's been our approach, is a cautious growth and growing where we know we're going to get a return, rather than getting greedy and growing too fast and then having to explain to our investors, sorry, we lost your money, but you know, now we know what we're doing. That's not what we wanted to do.
Sure.
So yeah, we've grown cautiously, and our investors – it has mainly grown through word of mouth rather than through any type of advertising we do.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side of the platform, the borrowers, we do some direct marketing to attract borrowers, but we haven't done any brand building. So Zopa is kind of known in the fintech circles, and it's known in the circles of our investors who are a sort of fairly niche group themselves that invest in peer-to-peer lending.
Mm-hmm.
But many people on the street, you're right, haven't heard of Zopa, and that's a huge opportunity for us to take the brand into that space.
Yeah. And so you talk about this being this idea about being customer focused and obsessed and things, and you've also won a bunch of customer service awards and so on and so forth. I mean, but what is service actually kind of mean to you guys? I mean, how do you kind of encapsulate that? Because I mean, there's a lot of people that can talk about, yeah, we're going to go to the ends of the earth to please our customers or to service our customers. What does that actually kind of mean for you guys?
It's kind of deeper for us. So
right,
Zopa was a company that founded to solve a customer problem, and that differentiates us from quite a lot of other companies. And certainly in my consulting career, I worked with a lot of great companies, but didn't find many that had that reason to exist that was as customer obsessed as Zopa. And it goes back to the original story of the founders looking at the world of financial services being frustrated that the everyday person didn't have access to financial products that other that high net worth and wealthy people could.
Right.
So as an everyday individual, if you had some money and you wanted to grow your money, your options were put it in a protected bank account, in which case you weren't getting much of a return, or perhaps you could invest it in property. But you know, a lot of people struggle to buy their own property, let alone a portfolio of investment property.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could put it into equity markets, which, you know, increasingly volatile today, but we're already a very volatile and risky market back in 2004.
Yeah.
And they looked at it and said, well, hang on, you know, a bank exists and has done for whatever 500 years to provide an exchange between those who have money and wish to give it to the bank in return for some interest in return,
mm-hmm.
and an exchange between those who don't have money and want to borrow some and are prepared to pay for it.
Sure.
And you know, the spread between what a bank pays you on your deposits and what you pay to borrow from a bank is pretty big, and has been historically like that since banks have started doing deposits and lending.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, well, is there another way here? And actually, could we use technology to provide that exchange so that customers get a better deal, which means that as an investor, I can lend my money directly and cut out the costs of a bank and therefore earn a better return. And as a borrower, because there's less cost, I can borrow at a cheaper price. So that was the concept behind it. Now, I have to be very careful to caveat that when you do peer-to-peer lending, it's not the same thing as putting your money in a bank, and we're not FSCS protected and your capital is at risk, and all of those caveats. I'm just talking about the thinking that went into the founding of the company.
Yes, of course.
So this was a place that was built in order to solve a customer problem, and thought that technology might help us to be able to do that.
Right.
So for us, you know, that is why even 13 years later, people are still coming to work here, because we are attracted by challenges and opportunities in financial services where we don't think customers are being well served or getting a great deal. And that's what we're on a mission to go and solve for, is to provide better value and simpler and fairer finance for everyday people.
Perfect.
And I think we're only scratching the surface of that.
Excellent. So now I come to the sort of the heart of the thing I wanted to talk to you about, because I think it's part of kind of how you drive towards solving those problems, but also,
yeah,
you know, the culture of the organization and what you stand for and your service and so on and so forth. And the thing I'm talking about is that idea of that there's been a lot of talk recently that an organization of the future, one that's going to be able to stay competitive and adaptable, has to become more kind of agile. And we see lots of firms that are really talking about that, and there's a lot of people treating agile as an initiative rather than as a way of working. And the reason why this kind of conversation came about is because I heard a colleague of yours, Amy, talking at a recent conference. She was talking about how you've taken this whole agile concept further and how you operate a system of self-organizing teams. So I was like going, I don't know what that is, and I want to find out more. So first of all, can I ask you to just describe what that means? Kind of what does a self-organizing kind of team mean? What is your system or organization way of working? How does it work?
There's kind of two parts of the story. I can answer the question directly or give you a bit of a meander and an explanation of how we got there. But
I tell you what, why don't you meander and get there? Because actually that's probably the color that's going to bring it all out. Because otherwise, if I might jump in and go, tell me what that is and how does that work?
So when I joined in 2014, as I said, we were about 50 people. And we had maybe 8 or so developers at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd come from a world of strategy consulting where I'd been working with big companies. And, you know, we'd been doing a lot of execution stuff. And I'd heard about Agile, but I'd never really experienced it in any great detail. And I arrived at this sort of 10-year-old at the time startup, Zopa. And I was kind of, I guess I trod on a few landmines with this kind of agile thing, which I didn't really understand, but it seemed quite alien to me at first, because when I reflect back, I think, you know, we were the worst of agile, because we had a business thing and we had a tech thing. And what agile meant was The business wasn't allowed to provide anything that looks like a requirement because, you know, that's heresy in the world of Agile. And the tech guys, you know, they'll take something, but they're not going to give you any indication of what you're going to get or when you're going to get it, because that's, again, heresy and not Agile.
Right.
So, you know, we were the worst of Agile. And I was kind of a bit confused by what this thing was and why it was deemed to be such a great thing, because it just didn't really seem to work for us.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we would spot good opportunities that where we could see growth in the business, but we were not able to execute at the pace that we really aspired to do. So we were landing one or two major initiatives each year. And so at the end of 2015, we sort of looked at the situation and said, if we want to achieve our ambition, we as an organization need to be able to execute on a far grander scale than we do today.
Right.
So why is it that we can't? And there were technical reasons why we couldn't, and there were cultural and organizational reasons why we couldn't.
Right.
The technical reason, I'll just mention and gloss over quickly. We had a system that by the time was 10, 11 years old. So it had a lot of hacks on it. And that meant, you know, you would change something in one area of the system and something would fall down somewhere else. So making changes on the system was a kind of fraught thing to do. And you couldn't really have independent teams working on it. So we did a lot of work to carve up our platform so that we could have independent areas of the platform that teams could work on that wouldn't impact other areas of the platform.
Right.
So that was the technical piece. The more interesting piece, I think, though, was the cultural and organizational piece. So we talked to our developers and our business people, and we said, why do you think it is that we're not able to land the right stuff at the right time? And the message we got back was, particularly from the developer community, was we don't have any sense of ownership of what we're doing, because, you know, we'll pick up projects that get chucked over us from the business. You might have smart guys in the business, but they don't really understand the tech, so they don't know the art of the possible.
Right.
And we as the developers don't really understand the business, so we don't really get what the value is. So we try and interpret what the business wants and come up with our own solutions for stuff, but we don't really understand what it is that you're asking for in the first place.
Right.
And so they're saying this lack of ownership was the central tenet behind our lack of pace and execution. So we said, okay, how do we go about solving that? And we looked around and we came across the Spotify model of tribes and chapters.
Right.
And, you know, everyone hails Spotify as the poster child for scaling agile software development.
Mm-hmm.
And their model was to, you can find blogs around their model, but to give a brief synopsis, it's around cross-functional teams that have ownership of particular areas of their platform.
Sure.
And so we kind of like that idea that if we put people together and gave them, you know, ring fence to areas of our business and said, right, you guys are responsible for this now, and you have all the resources you need from the different capability sets to go and solve it,
mm-hmm.
then that felt to us like it would solve some of those ownership problems.
Right.
And we'd have business people that better understood the tech and tech people that better understood the business. And the hope was therefore to have more effective innovation. There were a few problems that we saw in the Spotify model for our particular context. One of those is there's just more strategic risk in a lending business than in a music streaming business.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're a highly regulated business, and decisions being taken where there is no clear record of who took the decisions and why is very, very risky in a lending business.
Right.
So we adapted the Spotify model to suit our needs. So we created these cross-functional teams, and we actually went, I think, deeper than Spotify do. For them, I think it is a engineering thing. It's about designing, developing, and deploying code. For us, we said it's the whole business. So we're going to carve up the business into distinct areas. So we have a tribe called Unsecured Personal Loans.
Right.
And their objective is to grow the unsecured personal loans business. So that includes everything from marketing, copywriting, UX, front-end developers, back-end developers, business analysts, data scientists, everyone is in that tribe.
But
and
do you assign people to the to those kind of those areas, or do people assign themselves to those areas?
We assign. So we have cross-functional teams. So as a data scientist or as a developer, your team is your tribe, and you report into your tribe leader. So we don't have a matrix structure,
right?
And we don't operate in functional teams. We operate in business unit teams, and we call them tribes. So
right.
People would kind of get what we were aiming for, because we made the move very quickly. We sort of started talking about the problem in October 2015,
mm-hmm.
and on the 1st of January 2016, everyone was in tribes.
Right.
So it was a very rapid change. And in the first quarter of 2016, we delivered more than the whole of 2015, and that was with the same number of people.
Wow.
Yeah, it was an overnight success for us.
Did you lose anybody in the process?
We lost one or two, but actually we've been able to scale the business much more. So we've grown considerably over the last year and a half. And actually we've been able to attract and retain really great talent, because it's a much more interesting proposition whether you're a business person or a tech person. So because it's a fairly unique model, and if you're a developer, and developers these days, you know, they want to be doing stuff that creates impact.
Sure.
You know, it's less and less about taking requirements and writing code on the back of it. You know, ours is fortunately, it's an attractive market right now, the space of fintech.
Sure.
And we can offer developers a role that's different to what other companies can, where, you know, you're going to own your part of the business. You're going to drive the innovation and work collaboratively with the business people. And you're going to learn how value is created. And how customer experience is delivered, and be responsible for it. And it's that responsibility and ownership that was what we were trying to solve for. And, you know, we're insecure overachievers. So between you and I think we did a good job. But, you know, publicly, I'd have to say that we're not yet there. There's lots more we need to improve.
Can I ask, in terms of the, you know, what I was thinking about was that, so Q1 2016, you delivered basically the same amount as you did the whole of the calendar year 2015. So that, I mean, you said that. Mm. And now, so that implies to me that you've almost achieved a fourfold increase in productivity output.
Mm-hmm.
And now, on reflection, was ownership and responsibility the only constraints that you were able to kind of free up on, or was there something else that you didn't occur to you, and that just allowed you to achieve this quantum leap in productivity? Because that feels kind of bigger than just ownership and accountability.
Yeah, so, you know, there was a technical piece of, we have to be able to carve up the platform so distinct teams could own pieces.
Right.
But as you look at the Spotify model, they talk a lot about autonomy of tribes, and we used a lot of that terminology when we launched. And as much as we have carved up our technical platform, there are still dependencies between our tribes,
right?
Technical and strategic dependencies. So if our unsecured personal loans tribe creates a new lending product, you know, we need some investors who want to buy that product. So there's a strategic dependency there. So, you know, we've not tried to create these things as entirely autonomous. Actually, there needs to be huge coordination between these tribes. But for sure, having a platform where you can have people work fairly safely and independently is a prerequisite to this kind of tribal system that we have created.
Yeah, okay.
But, you know, other than that, it really is about creating that environment where you can find great people and give them problems to go and solve, and an environment and where they can go and go and solve those problems.
Okay.
And so, you know, we don't run a top-down organization. My role as chief product officer is to ensure that we have the right people in the right tribes tackling the right problems. But mm-hmm. it's not my job to come up with the answers to those problems, because, you know, that just wouldn't scale. We'd only be able to do, you know, the capacity, my mental capacity, which isn't that big. But by creating an environment where other people can solve the problems, it's just much more scalable.
Yeah.
So we've been able to use, and this was kind of an interesting side effect, or a kind of second order benefit, that the tribe system for us has worked well in really different contexts.
Mm-hmm.
So In some instances, we've used it in more of an optimization model. So take our unsecured personal loan tribe.
Yeah.
That's a business that's been going for 12 years. It's more about how do I ensure we're delivering better value, better service to customers that are already coming through our pipelines so that we get higher conversion. So it's an optimization challenge. We've used the tribes in other areas where it's more of a complete product relaunch. So
right.
For our investors, you know, we launched a new product set in 2016, and we just launched ISAs 2 months ago. But we've also used tribes for areas where we don't have anything today. So we've created mobile apps through tribes. We've used our tribes to launch into secured auto lending. And we now have tribes working on building us a bank alongside the existing business. So we found this model to be successful in different business contexts, which has been really interesting and appealing to see.
So kind of, I mean, let me kind of sort of just kind of almost drill down kind of like a level, because it seems, so there's a, I would imagine that there's probably a lot of people that are listening to this and going, oh, that sounds really exciting and innovative, and I want to be kind of part of that. I want to recreate sort of some of that sort of stuff. And they can go off and do their research but and then find out more. But a lot of the time, sort of, I guess, the devil's in the detail in many ways. And I think the thing that I would, the question I would have around if I was either thinking about being as if I was a team leader or executive or even just a professional, I'd want to get better understand how does this work on a practical day-to-day kind of level. I mean, you know, things like, did they have, you know, how do people manage their time, meetings, communication, all that sort of stuff? I mean, how does that actually kind of work? Does anything really change, or is it more just about you're pointed in the in a different sort of direction and you're aligned better, you know, if you understand what I mean?
Yeah, sure. So maybe I'll talk about some of the mistakes that we made early on.
Okay.
And how we've tried to correct them, because I don't want to make it out that, you know, we're smarter than anyone else or have perfected the system.
No, sure.
So when we launched our tribes, again, we referenced Spotify a lot, and probably a little bit too much. It was helpful because we did the thing so quickly and we didn't have all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
But the tribes, you know, if anything, perhaps went a little bit too far and went a bit too tribal. And it was quite hard to see what was actually going on in the tribes. And given the level of technical and strategic dependency between the things, that wasn't particularly helpful.
Right.
So we had to find a better way of aligning tribes. And the way that we did that is, you know, again, we kind of shamelessly pilfered from people who have solved the problem elsewhere. And we used the system called objectives and key results that I think Intel used to call management by objectives, and then it got popularized by Google.
Right.
And the way that we do this is we set a company objective, be that for the next 18 months or whatever it may be, and then we say, what are the key results that will tell us that we are hitting that objective?
Right.
And then that filters down. So, you know, our objective might be something like, we want to be the most exciting customer-obsessed fintech in the UK. And so what are the key results of us being there, or proof points that we're there? One of those might be sustainable customer growth. It
yeah.
might be on track to launch our next generation bank. It might be customer NPS above 85 or whatever. And then we use those to say, well, if that's what the company's trying to do, what can you as a tribe that owns this business area do in service of that objective?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a negotiation between the tribe and myself and CTO and CEO about how do they think they can service those objectives and key results. So the unsecured loans team might say, well, we can support strong customer growth by doing £1 billion of lending this year. Or whatever it may be.
Yep.
And we think we've got kind of five initiatives on our roadmap to do that. But that thinking comes from them, and it's then a negotiation to say, well, you know, what do we as a business feel are the priority things that we need to tackle? But it's the teams are then setting their own roadmaps and negotiating their roadmaps rather than it being pushed down.
Right.
So that creates the alignment, and it creates the sense of ownership as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But in terms of the kind of day-to-day working, once those, you know, the objectives and key results have been set, which we typically do on a quarterly basis,
mm-hmm.
It looks very much like you know, a modern agile environment. So the teams organize, they're free to organize around whether they want to do, you know, weekly sprints or fortnightly sprints or even Kanban or whatever model they want to adopt.
Okay.
It's up to them to self-organize. And, you know, there's a right model for the right people in the right context. So, you know, the teams will get together and a typical day would be, you know, people come in, they have their stand up, they talk about what's blocking them, they get on and do their work, they'll hold their retros on what went well in the last sprint, what didn't.
Right.
They'll hold their reviews of, you know, how are we doing against our objectives and key results. And that's the sort of daily working. But, you know, if other companies are looking to adopt a similar model, I think what worked for us was we didn't go half in, we went all in.
Right.
And it was an initiative. It was an initiative started from board level down that
yes.
we were doing this. It wasn't a sort of, you know, one team decided to try and do something slightly differently. The whole organization had to change in order to do this.
Yes.
And fortunately, we were at a size and had a level of buy-in in the organization that made that easy to do. So, you know, it was a challenge, but it wasn't as challenging as it might be in other contexts.
Absolutely. And so I guess, you know, you also kind of talked about that you're still thinking about developing it, sort of like, it, you know, it, there's still things that you're kind of, you want to improve. I mean, what are the things that you're looking to improve? I mean, because it sounds like you haven't reached a steady state in terms of this is how we work. We're going to fix it for X period of time, but it sounds like there's still things, tweaks that you're making. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that'll always be the case because, you know, Agile is about continual improvement and reflection on what's working and what's not working.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we as a business are growing in our appetite and ambition, as well as growing in people. So what worked for us 9 months ago may not work for us going forward. And we're trying to bed in this system of objectives and key results as a way of aligning teams.
Right.
And that's worked reasonably well. We've had to create new types of meetings and ways of working to drive that more regular alignment. So,
uh-huh.
you know, we have a weekly scrum of scrums where we have our tribe leads and our squad leads and other stakeholders get together. Actually, it was just before this podcast, every Tuesday morning, where we do a 30-minute quick kind of round the room of what's all the stuff that's going on and coming down.
Yes.
And that's where you create those moments of interaction that one squad lead is working on something and will say, hey, I'm doing this. And someone else will say, hey, that's going to impact me. We need to go and talk about it later.
Sure.
And, you know, previously that used to rely on the communication going up through me or through our CTO. But again, that's just not scalable because we can't be responsible for managing all of those interactions. It's far more effective if the relationships exist within the teams to go and talk to each other.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've had to create that environment to facilitate that.
Yeah.
And that's working really, really well for us. No one ever likes it when you say, hey, everyone, we're going to have a new meeting each week. this is one of the ones that really has been really effective for us. I think some of the other challenges we've had are around people management. So,
okay,
for our squad leaders and tribe leaders, and our tribes break down into smaller units, which we call squads.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, you have people, and you know, we have young people here, and they are responsible for managing people. And managing is always a challenge.
Sure.
And it's a challenge when you're managing someone that looks and thinks like you. But when you're managing someone that looks and thinks in a completely different way, it's even more challenging. So
sure.
As a squad lead, you know, you may have come from a technical background or you may have come from a commercial background or a marketing background or whatever it may be. And all of a sudden you're managing a UX person and a back-end developer and a copywriter and a data scientist. And, you know, you may have no experience of ever working with those people before.
Mm.
So, you know, people management has been something we've had to invest in quite heavily. An advantage of being a fairly organic organization and having tried it in different ways in different teams and tribes is we've been able to look around and go, where are people really enjoying their management experience and where is it proving productive and
sure.
What are the learnings from that we can apply into other places? So, you know, we keep looking for ways to improve the system and improve the experience of people in the system, because again, you know, my job is to make sure we've got great people who are highly motivated tackling the right problems.
Yeah.
You know, I think the next challenge for us, the big challenge for us, will be how do we move this way of working into a remote context? So right. At the moment, we're 250 people in a great office in London.
Mm-hmm.
But as we continue to grow, we've had to open up a satellite office in Barcelona because of the challenge in recruiting tech talent in London.
Yes.
And I can see that challenge only increasing. So, you know, we've survived thus far by being a very physical working environment, despite being an online business.
Yes.
Everything happens face-to-face and mm-hmm. in the same room.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have to translate our way of working into a remote context, which, you know, I wasn't able to get Skype working with you at the beginning of this podcast. So that's going to be a challenge for us to
yeah.
have teams of people all over the place. And, you know, we need to figure out a way to make that work, because the heart of our success has been creating those relationships where there weren't relationships before, i.e. between business people and tech people.
Yeah.
And that's easy when you sit next to them. It's kind of harder when you're in a different office or even different country and perhaps even speaking different languages. So
Can I give you a couple of kind of like kind of potential kind of pointers or clues, kind of who you might want to talk to kind of with respect to that?
I would love that, yeah.
First of all, I would say Basecamp. They're smaller than you, but they seem to have that whole remote working sort of thing completely dialed in. And their intentionality about being small but powerful is brilliant. And then there's another kind of firm that I recently spoke to. They're going to feature in an upcoming podcast, and that's LiveOps, who are a contact center sort of business, but they are completely remote. They have about 20,000 agents all working remotely.
Mm.
And so...
Great, thank you. I'll definitely listen to them.
And their whole skills development and people development part of it is like an essential part of kind of how they go about kind of doing that. So I think you're right in terms of scalability. You have to think more broadly. I think that those two guys are doing it sort of differently. There's kind of an art and craft of things, which is more of a Basecamp thing, but then there's a scale element, which is kind of probably more of a LiveOps sort of thing. So there's probably stuff that can be learned from both, I think.
Great, thank you. Well, as you probably gathered, our approach is to sort of pilfer best practices from everyone else. So
yeah.
I'll certainly look into those.
Excellent. But in terms of, I mean, so if I was going to say to you, like, so somebody's listened to this and you've mentioned Spotify, you've mentioned Intel and Google and those different things, and about the idea about going off and pilfering, learning from other people. I mean, but if somebody was to say, actually, I really want to learn more about this, immerse myself in this, I mean, do they have to just go out and do their own research, or is there a central place that they can go and just sort of like dive into? I mean, has somebody written a book that sort of describes all this? I mean, none really come to mind, but you might know of some stuff that have passed me by.
I don't know of any great resources, and I think it would be a really good topic for a book for someone to write up, or a series of blogs, because more and more people I talk to are trying to do similar things, and I think there are nuances to this thing that are subtle and people need to be aware of. And this has worked really well for us because of the challenges we were facing and because of the industry we're in and because of where we are in that industry.
Sure.
But I wouldn't be ideological about it and say every organization has to be like this and it will quadruple your productivity.
Mm-hmm.
It did for us because of where we were. So I think it's an area that's worthy of more research and knowledge being compiled on this worked well for these people in this context.
Yes.
And here's the learnings you can take from them. We looked at Spotify because they're very good at promoting their approach. And,
yes.
They have a number of blogs and slideshows and things like that that explain this thing. But other than that, it was kind of, you know, a little bit of research and talking to people and piecing stuff together and then test and learn. You know, we've got kind of a few bandages from where we made mistakes, which I'm always very happy to share with people so they don't make the same ones. But I think it'd be very useful to have some kind of centralized place for this, because, like I say, I don't think we've perfected it And it would be great to be able to have an environment where either through reading or discussing or whatever it may be, you know, we could share best practices with other people and talk about what's working.
Perfect. And so what's the, I mean, you mentioned it kind of earlier about this building a bank, an alternative bank, you know, is that the next big thing, next big challenge for you, like full-blown bank via banking license, take on the high street?
Yeah. So we, you know, we entered into 2016 on this, you know, to use your phrase, a sort of a paradigm shift in productivity, which gave us a newfound appetite and ambition. And we stepped back in the third quarter of 2016 and did a strategic review. And we said, if our mission is about making money, great value, simple and fair for people, how are we doing against that?
Sure.
And with our current model, for those borrowers who meet our risk appetite, which is, you know, very low risk borrowers, people who would normally borrow from the bank, but are looking for a better experience and a better deal, we provide a great experience for them. We provide great value for them.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who want to do peer-to-peer lending,
yes,
we provide a great experience for them. But there are lots of borrowers who we can't lend to. There are certain needs of our existing borrowers that we can't meet. And lots of our investors would like it if we could offer them some kind of protection over their money, because when you do peer-to-peer lending, it's not protected by the financial services compensation scheme.
Right.
And so we were looking at it saying, if we want to succeed in our mission, we need to have a much broader product set. And actually the peer-to-peer thing becomes a bit of a challenge when you try and break out of the products we already have. So if I think about our borrowers, a revolving loan product like a credit card is a great product and solves a whole bunch of needs that we can't solve with an unsecured loan. But actually, it's very hard to do a revolving credit card in a peer-to-peer world because, you know, I can't tell the investor how much of their money is going to be used or how it's going to be paid back.
Okay.
Because it's up to the borrower who owns the credit card. Do I use my full line? Do I do full repayment or minimum repayment? So it's very challenging in a peer-to-peer world.
Yes.
And again, if you want to offer your investors protection, you know, there's only one way to do that, which is to be able to offer them retail protected deposits. So,
yes.
So we said, in order to really succeed in our mission of making money simple and fair for people, we need to be able to offer a much broader product set. And to do that, we need to take on a banking license and be able to offer better value revolving products and protect FSCS protected deposits. So, so that's a big piece for us now is going off and building that. And that comes from, you know, this self-belief in our operational appetite, an organizational appetite that came from moving to a tribe model. So yeah, the next big thing is building a next generation bank, and you know, work is well underway on that, and we're hoping to launch in 2018.
Perfect. So Andrew, that, I mean, I know that we've got we've been going for a wee bit of time now, and I wanted just to ask, before I ask a couple of just kind of final questions, is there anything that you think that we've missed out in our rummage around your sort of your journey and things that you'd like to highlight before I ask you the last couple of questions?
I guess the one area we haven't really touched on is how do we drive that customer obsession and service mentality into the organization? And we do something which I, you know, wasn't my idea, but I think it's really cool. In our tribe system, we actually get real customers to come into the office and sit in front of the computer and go through the experience, be that taking out a loan or investing your money through peer-to-peer or trying to withdraw it or whatever it may be. And we sit people from the tribe in the room with that real person. And that has been incredibly powerful in terms of motivating the teams and particularly tech people who are quite often used to being, you know, right in the back office. When you sit there and you see a customer struggling to understand something that you own, it's an incredibly powerful way of driving that level of customer obsession.
Sure.
You know, you can code up a website and go, well, it kind of makes sense to me, so it probably makes sense to everyone else. And it's not until you see someone going, I just don't understand what that word means in this context. So I'm confused and I don't like this and I don't like that. it's just an incredibly powerful way of making people really care about the experience they're giving to people.
Yeah.
Sit them in a room and watch people struggle with the product you've created. And that has driven so many insights for us that has allowed us to improve our experience.
You know, I heard a similar story from the experience of The Atlantic, you know, the publication?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They went through a big sort of UI, UX sort of redevelopment, redesigned all their sort of website and everything else, and then sort of went through a testing sort of kind of process. I think I'm getting this right, but actually what they ended up doing is they ended up bringing people in, the actual Atlantic subscribers, readers, users, whatever, into a room, and then had everybody basically watch them to see how they interacted with different parts of the website.
Yeah.
And what's absolutely fascinating is this idea that we make assumptions that something's simple and it gets completely blown out of the water when somebody else looks at it through a different set of eyes, a different set of experiences, a different set of understandings. And it's both leveling and humbling and devastating and insightful all at the same time. And
yeah.
they kind of lauded that sort of that whole approach around the idea of about assumptions and design and what works and what doesn't work is absolutely nothing until you actually show it to somebody and say, does it work?
Absolutely. And you know, you could spend 3 weeks with the smartest brain solving a problem, and then when you come to your solution, you know, you've got 3 weeks of collective knowledge that went into it, so you understand it. But then you show it to someone who's got a million other things to do in their day, and you know, they'll probably be quite confused and misunderstand what you were trying to do. So, yeah, I think it's a great approach. And, you know, by putting the people who do the actual coding sat next to a real customer and letting them feel their anguish and pain, it's just hugely motivational for, you know, how can we make things better for our customers?
Perfect. So that brings me to my final two questions, Andrew. And the first one is a little bit of a selfish one, because it's a bit of a piece of ongoing research that I've been doing, because I wrote a book that came out last year called How to Wow. And ever since then, over the last year, I've been asking people for their perspective on what is wow service or experience to them. So I'd be really interested to hear your take on that.
Yeah, so I think for us, it's about starting with the customer needs and solving around that. So I think all too often, customer service is a team, and really what they're there to do is solve the problems that are inherent in the products and services that companies have created.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of, we create this thing and then let's let our customer service team deal with the problems that it springs up. And I don't think that's what customer service really is and really should be.
Yes.
I think you should start with the customer needs and build customer service and customer experience in at the front. So it's not something that you do to paper over the cracks. It's something that is inherent in the product or service design from day one.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people who are going out and running these research sessions to really understand people's frustrations and people's needs, and then building the products and services around that. For me, that's around, you know, how you create a wow experience is, you know, don't just settle for the status quo, but challenge.
Yes.
And don't make assumptions on how customers think. Go and ask them.
Yes.
Because you'll almost certainly be wrong.
Brilliant. And then that brings me to my final question that I always ask at the end of these podcasts. And I think I've done over, there's about 225 or thereabouts at this point. And that question is, Andrew, is there anything that you would like to shamelessly plug?
Honestly, no. I'm good. if I was to plug anything, I'd say, you know, we have a great company at Zopa. We're trying to do great things. We're having a great time doing that. And if people are interested in coming and joining this story, then we're always on the lookout for great talent. So if I had a plug, that would be it. Come join Zopa.
Perfect. Andrew, I'll make sure I get all that edited up and linked up and give you guys a big kind of shout out when it goes live. But I just want to say thank you for helping us look inside this kind of exciting new way of working that you're developing at Zopa. And congratulations on your success. And thank you for sharing your time and experience with us today.
Thank you for indulging me. It's a story I love telling. So pleasure is mine.